To the 2011 Gregory Lecture in honor of the Reverend Dr. Paul and Catherine Helen Gregory. We're so glad that they're able to be here with us this morning. Welcome, Paul and Kit. Thank you for coming this morning. It's been a joy that since 1985, Lancaster Theological Seminary accepted the offer of First Congregational Church of Montclair, New Jersey, to establish a lectureship in international missions to be known as the Paul and Catherine Gregory Lectureship. Paul Gregory is a graduate of Lancaster Theological Seminary from the class of 1944. We were just talking with them a little bit about their experience and about some of the interesting rules that were in place at that time. Paul and Catherine, or Kit as she goes by, Gregory, have served the church with exceptional skills, pastoring missionaries in China and Japan, and as secretary for the Pacific area, and as general secretary of missions for the United Church Board for World Ministries. We at LTS continue to give thanks for the ministry and witness of Paul and Kit Gregory and First Congregational Church of Montclair, New Jersey. It's also my joy to introduce our speaker this morning, Dr. Michael Gilligan, president of the Henry Luce Foundation. I was calculating the years this morning that I have known Michael for 26 years now. He was my college English professor back in 1985 and made a lasting impression on me as a professor and has continued to be a great mentor and a friend these 26 years. So I'm very grateful that he's here this morning. Dr. Gilligan received his BA from Duke University and his MA and PhD, which is in rhetoric and literature, from the University of Virginia. Earlier in his career, he was the academic dean and professor of English at the Pontifical College Josephinum, which is where I knew him originally, a Roman Catholic seminary in Columbus, Ohio. Today, he is the president of the Henry Luce Foundation and has held that position since January 2003. Established in 1936 by Henry R. Luce, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Time magazine, the Luce Foundation today includes grant-making programs that support higher education, American art, environment, theology, women in science and engineering, and understanding of Asia. During Dr. Gilligan's presidency, the foundation has developed four multi-year commitments: the Henry R. Luce Initiative in Religion and International Affairs, the Luce Initiative on East Asian Archaeology and Early History, the American Art Renewal Fund, and the theology program's focus on forming leaders for a religiously plural society. As many of you know, the recent trip by our students to Thailand was sponsored by the Luce Foundation, a grant from the Luce Foundation for both us and the Southern Conference of the UCC. And given the current state of world events, I believe that Dr. Gilligan's lecture is timely for us all. I know that I am looking forward to hearing what he has to share with us. Friends of God, please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Gilligan.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Thank you, David. This is the Gregory Lecture, but I'm standing on the Annabelle Prophet footstool here in the back. but because I wear trifocals, I wasn't sure where I was standing. David, thank you for that kind introduction. And thank you all for the invitation to speak today at this historic and dynamic seminary. I was reminded this morning in conversation with Elizabeth Soto and some of the students who were part of the trip to Thailand last month about the pioneering work of the seminary. Really, since the 1820s, but in this past century, the pioneering work about cross-cultural exploration. I mean, while my talk today is not particularly about mission, it's really about foreign policy and the role of religion, I feel as if I'm in a very safe place. to talk about cross-cultural exchange and its richness and also some of its vexation. There are a lot of reasons it's a joy to be here. One is just because of the identity of this place. I feel really privileged to be here, a little bit like the Archbishop of Canterbury standing up here in this podium. There's this recent partnership between the Luce Foundation and LTS and the UCC that's allowing some of this work to be supported that you've undertaken in Thailand, particularly with partners at Phayaprom University. Phayaprom is an old partner of the Luce Foundation. The chapel there is named for Henry Luce. My experiences of the seminary date back to the early 90s when I was working on the staff of the Association of Theological Schools. And for 5 years, I worked in accrediting and developing the new, what we thought then as the new standards of accreditation. And in that work, one of my regular partners was Dr. Bud Hartley. In fact, he was one of my mentors, as were some of the other, I think primarily the administrators of the seminary at that time. As David said, we have a long, long friendship. And today, I think we share a particularly strong interest in the sort of rethinking and the re-envisioning of what theological education should look like, can look like, had better look like, if we're going to function. And finally, this gives me a chance to honor the Gregories for their amazing work and mission in some of the hardest years. For Christian mission in East Asia in the past century, when folks had gone with a strong commitment to work in China, and then because of the change of the government there, were unable to stay, and then needed another cross-cultural experience and needed to prepare themselves for that. I think that experience of adaptiveness that they had in the 1950s, well, the 1940s and 1950s, really prepared them to be international leaders in understanding of mission from a kind of post-colonial perspective, to think of themselves humbly as partners with the people that they were reaching out to. It's an example that we're still moved by, and I'm so delighted that the folks at Montclair chose to honor you in this way because I get to ride on your coattails. It's also an honor to talk to you today about something that's been important to the Luce Foundation for a couple of years. And to talk about this enormous challenge that leaders in this country have been struggling to address. Specifically, that is, how do we understand and engage the world's religions in our country's practice of international affairs? Let me give you the caveat. David told you I'm an old English teacher, a very old English teacher at this point. I come to this not from a scholarly background. I'm really a practitioner, but I'm a practitioner these days of philanthropy, not of international affairs or of religion. I come at it from someone who is bringing funding to assist other people's good work. And so some of what I will say will sound kind of mechanical, I'm afraid, but we'll be happy to try to mix it up with you if you want to get underneath the surface of some of these projects that I'm going to describe. David described the Luce Foundation from our website and from my bio description. It's the foundation that was created by Henry R. Luce, the founder of Time Magazine, back in 1936, fairly early in his own career. Because he had grown up as a missionary kid in China in the 1890s, his family was also expelled, but during the Boxer Rebellion, not during the Mao Revolution. Because he had grown up there, three of the foundation's core interests have always been the understanding of East and Southeast Asia, higher education, and the leadership of the church, a program that we call theology. About 7 years ago, the directors and staff of our foundation were brainstorming about what we might do today that would particularly honor the founder's vision, some way that we might carry on Henry Luce's commitment to big ideas and also to the public good. And after 2 years, Jim Laney, one of our board members, a Methodist minister, is the former president of Emory University and then ambassador to Seoul during the Clinton administration. Jim Laney said, I can't think of any bigger idea that needs more attention, that's a better fit for us than to think about this problem of religion and how little the U.S. government understands it. And so with no more thinking about it than that, we set off for about a year to figure out what we might do, and then started funding. And in the past 5 years, we've approved more than $16 million of grants trying to get at this somehow. I still read newspaper in this version, not online. And in the past week or so, I've been tearing out things that I intended to read on the train last night if I'd been able to stay awake to talk to you about that are more specific. But any look at the past couple of weeks' headlines would remind you or remind me that there's still much to understand in this connection between religion and international affairs. In the past few weeks, our foreign policy establishment, the media, indeed, most of us have been taken by surprise. And more often, those have been bad surprises than good ones. The question that we raise at the foundation and that our project, our initiative has been about is, do we have the resources and the leadership that we need to understand these stories? Let me just click off a few of the stories. I mean, the happy story, the happiest story in the last couple of weeks in my mind is maybe besides the Packers win in the Super Bowl, but the happiest headline was the referendum in Sudan, in southern Sudan, on January the 9th. Just an extraordinary picture of you know, this huge percentage of the voting population turning out essentially to create a new democracy. In that story, the newspapers have not carried as much as the religious press the role of the religious leaders, particularly Archbishop Daniel Dung, the Anglican Archbishop of southern Sudan, and the Roman Catholic Archbishop Paulina Lukuru, who are really the Desmond Tutus of Sudan and who have helped us to understand the way that the sort of Arab-influenced Muslim North interacts with the African native influence and the animist and Christian South over that strong fault line that Liza Griswold was talking about in the 10th parallel. An amazing story and a happy one, a promising one at least. Less happy is the story from Lebanon of Hezbollah's role in the selection of the new prime minister. It raises huge questions about the safety of religious minorities in Lebanon, where there has been an uneasy truce, not just for generations, but for centuries, you know, of historic Christian groups and Muslims of various stripes, of Jews and others from that end of the Mediterranean, but with people also from Western Europe. Who knows what's going to happen under this new administration? But clearly there's going to be a shakeup in the way that Lebanon relates to the rest of the Shiite Muslim world. And particularly in relationship to Iran. And that reopens then the question of the relationship between Israel and Lebanon. It's been so painful and so vexing. Hezbollah has come to leadership with his prime minister because of the pain that was experienced in southern Lebanon in the last Israel incursion, that the Israeli incursion was so powerful that it has driven the Lebanese into the arms of Hezbollah. We see a similar tension growing. These aren't all Muslim tensions. You know, the last two, the one in Africa and the one in Lebanon, are Muslim and other tensions, but they're not always. I mean, the one on the India-China border that was on the front page of the New York Times this week is about Buddhism, where the 17th Karmapa, this reincarnate Lama, still in his 20s, who has become just an enormous figure around the world and Buddhist spirituality, is being accused by the Indian government of being a Chinese spy. In fact, he's not welcome in China. He is part of the Tibetan diaspora. But it raises very interestingly what the strain is between the world's two largest nations and how it may very well be played out. I mean, the autonomous region of Tibet, from which the Dalai Lama fled, 50 years ago, plus stretches along much of that border, but the Tibetan diaspora, the diaspora of Tibetan people, stretches much farther, all the way across the Himalayas. And so this is going to become a fault line like the one along the 10th parallel that Eliza was talking about in her book. And certainly changes are going to come when the Dalai Lama dies. And at 74, I guess, or 75, the Dalai Lama remains strong and hearty, but it will be another incarnate Dalai Lama who will be dealing with this. Hu Jintao's visit to the U.S. a couple of weeks ago raises the questions again. Everybody wants to know, certainly everybody who is to the right of the religious middle in this country wants to know what Barack Obama is saying to Hu Jintao about religious freedom and about the rights of religious minorities in China. Very bad record at the time of the Olympics. Terrible persecution of the Uyghur Muslim minority people, the ethnic minority from the West. And we watch this with great concern, but also a sense of wonder. We're all dazzled by the economic miracle of China, where the fastest growing segment of the population, is Christian. Most dramatic in the last week or so have been these populist movements, what sometimes are being called the populist contagion, that has spread from Tunisia to Egypt and Jordan and Yemen. I mean, reading these stories, and I mean, remember, I'm an amateur in this work, but reading these stories, I'm reminded that we so often treat the Muslim Middle East as if it's a single entity, that we really don't have an understanding of the diversity there. And the U.S. has chosen partners, oddly, in the Middle East, in the same way that we often did in Latin America. And in Cuba, for instance, in the past, or in the Philippines. And so Egypt, which is the largest of the Arab nations, a Muslim-majority country, of course, but one with a very strong Christian and a historic Christian presence, it seems that we have probably for too long hitched our wagon in foreign policy to the wrong star. Supporting the Mubarak administration because of its strong stance in support of Israel and its great work in the peace accords, we have stayed on too long. And so we're in this odd position that we've often been in, whereas in the U.S. we have to support movements that are for self-determination and democracy, for the expression of the world's people to be themselves. And we find that those movements are coming up against these other autocratic administrations that we've supported because of our foreign policy objectives or because of our economic interest, of course. And so I keep saying I'm really an amateur. I don't mean to be condescending about our country's leaders in the State Department or the Congress or in the military. These are smart people. Committed to their work, highly skilled in specific disciplines, but who have amazing and very damaging blind spots. Let me give you an analogy to my own blind spots. When I went to work at the ATS, that was 1993, and I had been working, as David said, in Roman Catholic education for about 20 years before that, most recently in seminary education. And my colleague, Dan Aylshire, who is now the executive director of ATS, spent weeks when I first arrived trying to help me to understand the spectrum of politics and polity among Protestant Christians in this country. Every day was like a new lesson kind of in movements I had never heard about, and sort of like where the disciples related to the UCC, to the non-instrumental Church of Christ, and I would just glaze over. I couldn't believe how little someone who knew as much about religious life and seminary formation as I did, how little I knew about my Protestant neighbors. And my mother had grown up in the EUB. And I thought, where do I come from that I don't know this stuff? And how in the world am I possibly going to function in the world of the ATS with 250 different schools? But over the next 5 years that I was there, I visited 175 of the seminaries in this country, 50 outside of the country, and I came to understand from learning on the ground some of what the history is and how a history like this seminary's, dating back to the early 19th century, continues to shape its mission and its stance in the world, and at the same time gets shaped then by its new participants over time and by the changing realities in which it's situated. So in the remaining 20 minutes or so, what I'd like to do is, and I think I've written a talk that will last about 9 hours, but I'll talk for 20 minutes. In the next 20 minutes, what I'd like to do is to talk about three things. First, what it is that the Luce Foundation sought to do when we got into this area in religion and international affairs and how we initially chose to proceed. Because I think it's a little bit of a case study about engagement and maybe about religious communities and engagement. The second one is what we've learned from the first 5 years of this practice. And the third is what this learning might imply for folks in religious leadership and particularly in theological education. At almost the same time, really in the very same year that I was getting settled at ATS and making my discovery about American Protestantism, or American Protestantisms, that two seminal works appeared in this country. The first was Sam Huntington's landmark article in Foreign Affairs, which at that time was published with a question mark, Clash of Civilizations, in 1993. The political scientist from Harvard, who then later wrote a book-length version of it that took away the question mark. Huntington at that point really reshaped the narrative, for me but for a lot of other people, about conflicts among nation states and recast them as larger patterns of conflict among transnational identities. That part was right. That certainly with the movement of peoples, the resettlement of peoples around the world, and with technology, we could no longer really focus on nation state and in a global economy. Unfortunately, the short form of that was what was paid attention to, and that was pitting what was described monolithically as the West against something that was similarly described monolithically as Islam. A few months after Sam Huntington's article appeared in Foreign Affairs, but already at work at the same time, was a book by Doug Johnston and Cynthia Sampson. Doug had been a U.S. Navy admiral, had worked in the Defense Department for a number of years, had then gone off to the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, so a major security specialist, but a believing Christian. Their book was called Religion, the Missing Dimension of Statecraft, 1994, that contained case studies about the unfortunate consequences of how little we know in the U.S. government and about our kind of vexing inability to understand the role of religion in countries where our interests have been so significant. Although these two studies, Sam Huntington's and Doug Johnston and Cynthia Sampson's studies, were really quite different, they both pointed to the same set of learnings. The first one was that what Peter Berger and others had called the secularization hypothesis no longer could be seen as valid. Secularization hypothesis had held that with increasing modernization, we'd see a decline in religion. And obviously, that did not happen. Peter Berger more recently wrote that we live in an age of explosive, pervasive religiosity around the world. And so the first was that we had to nix the secularization hypothesis. The second was that religion could no longer be treated by the government as primarily something in the private sphere, as a matter of individual choice, but it had to be factored into our understanding of public life at home and abroad. And the third was that the way we construed the relationship between church and state in this country might well get in the way of our understanding the way that religion was playing out in other countries. Okay. And I'll come back to this, but I just wanted to highlight, okay, nixing secularization, second, that religion couldn't be understood as private, and third, that our way of seeing church and state might put blinders on us when we thought about other countries. Johnson and Sampson highlighted some cases that demonstrated the necessity of understanding religious and spiritual factors, particularly in conflict and conflict resolution. They looked, for instance, at the U.S. government's totally inadequate understanding in the late 1970s of what was happening in Iran. How with the movement of the Shah, whom we had supported for a long time, we were absolutely unprepared for the emergence of an Islamic State. We didn't know where it was coming from, and we didn't understand really at that point the divide between Sunni and Shia Muslims in the region. Their attention, though, wasn't focused exclusively on Islam in the Middle East, and so they looked, for instance, at our inability to have understood the Sandinista movement in Nicaragua, and what later that the impact of that would have in Salvador and in Honduras and in southern Mexico and Chiapas, where the issue was really about Christians, but that we didn't get it. We didn't know what the role was of these popular religious leaders who had embraced liberation theology and what a challenge that would be to the economic models. These gaps that they talked about nearly 20 years ago continued when we got to Iraq in 2003, when our team totally misunderstood the possibility of sectarian violence. Colonel Mansour, in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, wrote that he was in charge of part of the the occupation army. He wrote that at the outset of our war in Iraq, our leaders, and he's really describing the Rumsfeld-Cheney team in this case, they were the architects, believed that the assault in Iraq would play out primarily as a conventional war in the same sort of high-tech model where our enormous military technical superiority would just overwhelm the Iraqis, as it did. But then where the stabilization effort would be only a little more difficult than it had been in Kosovo. A total misestimate. John Hamry, who is the head of CSIS, but was the chief operating officer of the Pentagon during those years, told me in 2004 that our representatives' lack of recognition of the motivations and inspiration of the key religious leaders in Iraq would condemn us to a long-time occupation. That Paul Bremer did not know the difference between the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani and Muqtada al-Sadr. He didn't know who their followers were and how the tribes would function, what their roles would be. And because of that, we unleashed, really we, the U.S. unleashed untold violence and suffering simply because we had failed to prepare the diplomats we sent there to understand the religious differences on the ground. So at the outset of our initiative, which was coming right after John Hamry told me that, we set out to do three things. The first was to get more involved in the training of the next generation of religious leaders. Or not religious leaders, of political leaders. Religious leaders is the last thing I'll talk about. To become more involved in the training of the next generation of policymakers, specifically in this country, military leaders too, so that they would no longer see religion as something on the margin. We tried to infiltrate, really, the graduate schools of international relations by seeding courses, providing faculty exchanges, doing the same kind of things you're doing with PIAP, but in the graduate schools of international relations, so that people would say, well, sure, if you're going to work in international affairs, you need to know economy, and you need to know security, and you need to understand military, and you need to know geography and language, and we would say, and you need to know religion. The second was we thought we could at least, if we had enough money, that we could at least add wind to various sails. So when people had already made a commitment to know more about this, we wanted to get behind them somehow. And our interest in that case was that we thought there were insufficient resources, but also there wasn't adequate dissemination, that the good information wasn't getting to the right folks. The third thing that we wanted to do was to create a buzz in the media, because we thought that the most important way you influence policymakers is not by smart thinking, but by constituents' phone calls. And so we just thought, let's get everybody talking about religion and international affairs. And so we provided money for Krista Tippett's program, Speaking of Faith, now what's called On Being, and Religion and Ethics News Weekly. But then we thought, only religious people are interested in Religion and Ethics News Weekly. So then we got into PRI, The World, and provided coverage for their international reporting to add a religious dimension to it, to American Abroad Media, to the training of new journalists at the Annenberg School and at Syracuse, thinking we've got to get a buzz or else we're not going to get anywhere on this idea. So what have we learned? A little, I learned some new things just by kind of rereading the list of grants getting ready to come down here for the talk. One of the great, when you work in a foundation, you always talk about we learned this and we learned that. Really, other people learned it with your money. But one of the great things that we discovered was we supported this publication very early on by a team at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, in Washington. It was actually written by a 24-year-old woman who was a research assistant to Rick Barton and Karen von Hippel in their project in post-conflict reconstruction. The question they set out to answer was who in 2007 and 2008 in the U.S. government was thinking about religion? They just tried to figure out who out there. They interviewed hundreds of people. They read all of the literature. They put together all kinds of focus groups just to say who here is thinking about religion, and then how are they thinking about it? What are they thinking? Why are they thinking about it? The initial discoveries were pretty bleak. They found out that one of the reasons that U.S. government officials don't think about religion, that they're reluctant, is that they're afraid of legal questions about church-state conflict. Or they're worried about America's image as a Judeo-Christian nation in other parts of the world. Or they just think that religion is too complicated and too sensitive and they don't have the time and money to get at it. They also found out that the pervasive frameworks for understanding religion in the U.S. government are simply narrow, that they tend to treat religion as problematic or as monolithic, that our approach to religion overemphasizes terrorism, it overemphasizes Islam, it doesn't pay attention to Hinduism or Sikhs, it doesn't look other places besides the Middle East until we're surprised in Sudan or in Nicaragua. Or it marginalizes religions we've talked about before and just says religion is kind of a humanitarian issue, cultural issue. Another is that even when folks are committed, their capacity is very limited. So that the institutional capacity to understand religion is very limited, partly because of their sense of legal limitations, but also because they simply lack religious training and because they don't take religious professionals very seriously. And so we end up with a government that's really structured only to work with state actors, when in fact Sam Huntington was right, that the key actors are often transnational, and that people say in Nigeria, their primary identity is their religious identity, not even their ethnic one, certainly not their national one. I had just a great experience of it as I was coming in and met one of you all, one of the MDiv students, and I said, where are you from? And he said, the UCC. And I thought, that's exactly what people in Nigeria would say. You know, who are you? And they'd tell you their name first, and the next thing they would say is that they were Christian or Pentecostal or Muslim. The good news is that the research that we've conducted indicates, and that CSIS conducted, indicates that there really is progress in the past 15 years. There's much more sensitive understanding of religious difference in the intelligence community. And that's, I think, a key starting place. And the folks who are gathering intelligence for defense and security studies, there is a real understanding of religious diversity on the ground. The second is that the military has worked very hard to come to be respectful of religious difference. It's taken a long way. This is a long, long road. I mean, you think Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a long road. This is from Don't Ask, Don't Tell to kind of working with local imams in Pakistan for our military officers is very difficult. I had a chance to have lunch with General Stanley McChrystal, who got fired because of his Rolling Stone interview, so he's now available for interviews for lunches with me. But General McChrystal was, I was asking him, what was the experience? What's it like to be the U.S. general who's in charge of Afghanistan? And, people must have hated you. It must be awful. And he said, it's the opposite. He said, Afghanis are people who believe in reciprocity. And they believe that because of their role in the conflict with Russia, that they were responsible for the collapse of Russia and the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that therefore the U.S. owes them something for making us the only superpower. And he said, so every place people Every place he went in Afghanistan, people thanked him for coming back and said, you owed this to us. And so the military, I think, is really working hard to gather this sense of nuance. USAID has obviously gotten much better at it. The State Department, with a variety of initiatives, is better as well. Let me jump to just a couple of examples and then move into the theological education piece and quit. One of the interesting stories, I think, in the past a little bit more than a decade has had to do with international, with our understanding of religious freedom. In 1998, saw the passage, this is the second Clinton administration, saw the passage of the International Religious Freedom Act, the creation of an ambassador at large. The first one was Bob Seipel, who had been the head of World Vision, an evangelical leader of this country. So there's an ambassador at large who reports to Assistant Secretary of State. And this is the end of the Clinton years. And the pressure for this had come primarily from conservative Christians in this country, but also from the Jewish community, interested in the protection of religious freedom, understood in a particular way. From the very beginning, this ended up getting somewhat skewed. What the ambassador and the department ended up paying attention to primarily was tracking examples of abuse of religious freedom rather than promoting religious tolerance, which really should have been its objective. They understood that they had three jobs. One was to document religious persecution. The second one was to free religious prisoners. And the third was to create understanding about religious difference. But they got so involved in the first two, in writing their annual report about religious abuse, focused a lot in China, interestingly, that they never got around to promoting religious tolerance. That's somewhat better today because of the State Department's initiative on contact with the Muslim world, and that's come since Obama's talk in Cairo, particularly that's really become enriched and powerful. But we went off track in the Bush administration, clearly, on this particular issue, where George Bush understood it, the International Religious Freedom Act as essentially to make the world safe for Christian missionaries and for Christian evangelism. And that really was not the intention of the original act. So today, one of the things we're working at is we think this question of religious freedom is desperately important. It's critical, really, and it's a value that the U.S. is uniquely suited to address. But it must be much more nuanced. Tom Farris, who was the head of that office in the State Department, is now teaching at Georgetown and is mixing it up there, I think, with good colleagues. An amazing Muslim woman at the University of California, Berkeley, has just organized a project that involves law schools all around the U.S. trying to get at a more nuanced, more pluralistic understanding of religious freedom. And I think 13 years after the passage of the Act, we may really be on to something. The second is an interesting example, I think, is our work with development organizations. I mentioned how USAID has done so much better. Mark Juergensmeyer, who wrote that amazing book, Terror in the Mind of God, back in the 90s, that got so much attention at the time of the World Trade Center attack. Mark has gone to teach at the University of California at Santa Barbara at Paul Orfelas Center. And he's looking particularly at raising up the visibility and then enhancing the capacity of religious-based development organizations. These have been a lot marginalized. The USAID didn't know how to work with Red Cross, and it certainly didn't know how to work very well with Church World Service or Catholic Relief or Episcopal Relief and Development or Lutheran World Services. It just didn't get it. You know? And again, there was this church-state divide that got in the way. But there are now studies underway at a number of universities, but the bringing together of practitioners with theologians to figure out how it is we can address this question of delivering real development service. It's not easy because it gets us then into the question of organizations like Hamas that are great providers of education and relief services. And so we say we want to work pluralistically with faith-based organizations, and yet we have a real concern about doing business with the enemy and with consorting with terrorists. The third is that I just mentioned efforts at post-conflict reconstruction, because I think that these have been among the most telling for us. I refer to this project, this Mixed Blessings project from CSIS. Their initial work was in the Balkans, where they were trying to figure out what were the forces that were helping to reconstruct the Balkans after the collapse of Yugoslavia and after the spread of ethnic conflict. And what they realized was that the understudied component of that was the role of religious actors. And so since then, they have moved from post-conflict reconstruction to conflict-prone societies, and they are working in case studies, developing case studies that will help us to understand how religious actors can be involved, not just in creating conflict, obviously, but in resolving it. We ask what's next. I mean, I went through that long catalog at the beginning about stories that are in the news. Obviously, I focus more today on development and economy, on security studies, amazing issues still to be dealt with relating to gender, to sexual orientation, to poverty, to the environment. There's a wonderful project just getting underway called Contending Modernities about how historic, this is at Notre Dame, but it's a national project, about how secularism and other modern forces interact with historic religious traditions and beliefs. I think one of the greatest challenge, and this takes me then to talk about theological education, I think the greatest challenge that we still face is how you get the best information into the hands of people who work on the ground. Yeah. This is exactly the challenge that you have in the seminary. This is the challenge of theologians, religious writers, religious journalists, is how is it that these profound resources, all of this research evidence, can really enrich the life of communities of faith and then the larger communities in which those communities of faith exist. For the last 5 years at the Luce Foundation and this initiative, we've been focusing on think tanks, on the policy community, on the military, on academics, the media. But our longtime interest is really in preparing religious leaders and religious leaders for religiously plural society. So wrapping up, let me just hit on a couple of things that I think some of the implications that I think might be important for a community like yours and for religious leaders like you. The first is it's very clear that religious leaders have responsibility both to form and to inform. I don't know where else in small communities, like the little one that I grew up in, Appalachian, Ohio, I don't know where else people go except to their pastor to get information about the world's religious traditions. They either do that or Fox News. And if you don't want Fox News to shape the dialogue and frame the narrative, you've got to prepare religious leaders to be able to understand and appreciate religious difference. You are the folks who can shape and direct the power of religion. You're the ones who can influence local communities to do that. The question is, what do seminaries do to prepare leaders for that role? I think from my own experience of seminary and the years I've watched it, that seminaries are one of the key places left in our culture where people really think about vocation all the time, and where students are invited to and often forced to explore the relationship between these two central human needs, the need for identity and the need for belonging, to kind of work back and forth between who I am and where I fit and what I have a responsibility to do, the relationship between kind of like my unique journey in faith and the community's needs, that place you're called to where your deep joy meets the world's great hunger, we often describe it. It's really important. These are the key questions in the Middle East, questions about identity and belonging. These are the questions in Sudan. These are the questions in Malaysia today. And so it's important for you to think about by analogy, as I was describing my own understanding about Protestantism. It's important for you to understand how this work that you do about identity and belonging, this work of exploring vocation, is at the center of understanding religious difference, and is particularly about influencing the formation of young people, particularly in volatile areas, as they come to understand who they are and where they belong and whose they are. Seminaries in their historic curriculum are probably among the best at linking what's present with what's historic. We're called also, and this seminary has shown the lead in linking what's local to what's global. The presence of old German Reform folks and Mennonites down the road that presence has shaped the work here, but it's also woven you into a global reality that you're really called to address. Theological education, I think, helps its graduates learn to balance commitments between the need to embrace a richly particular expression of faith, to anchor yourself in a particular tradition, and at the same time to recognize that we're all just one family, that there is really only one creator, whether we call ourselves Sunnis or Episcopalians. Auburn Center for the Study of Theological Education a couple years ago provided a kind of shocking finding that seminaries were almost invisible in the communities where they existed. That even in small towns where seminaries had had an historic presence, that you could stop people on the street and ask them where the seminary was. And they might know where the property was. And then you would say, tell me something about the seminary. And they didn't know anything. I think that one of the key issues for us is to deal with that. You know, somehow to counter the sense that religion is private, that religion exists on the margin. And somehow for us in the seminaries to cultivate practices of engagement in the public square, in all of the public squares, that can somehow be transformative. Over the years, from my contact with the seminary, one of the things that I know that you are best at and that you're committed to in your work at PIAP and with partners in Thailand today is to become partners for peace. Too often religion is seen, as it has been seen by our government, as part of the problem. This is our unique opportunity in a Christian seminary, as this one identifies itself, to be partners with the Prince of Peace and to somehow bring that light to the world. This is a worthy challenge, I think. And the tricky thing is that we're trying to shed more light and at the same time to keep the temperature down. That's a real challenge. You know, just to keep flooding the room with light and at the same time to realize it's hot in here already and that we've got to somehow bring that temperature down and yet make things more visible. We thought this was a worthy challenge for the Luce Foundation the last 5 years. We're going to stick with it for a while. You're kind to be interested in hearing something about it today. I'll be available for some questions to take a couple right now. But I thank you for your interest in the work, and I also thank you for your work on behalf of all God's people. Thank you.
So we have some time for a few questions. Somebody have a question for Dr. Gilligan? I'm sure somebody does. Sure.
What time is
fine? Thank you, Dr. Gilligan. As I heard you, the first question that was emerging from my thinking process in your challenging lecture was, in all this picture, where is World Council of Churches? Where is National Council of Churches? Are you perceiving the same indifference? Are they engaging the challenges of the time to promote the leadership, religious leaders that we need around the world and in this nation?
Thanks, Elizabeth. I think that's a hard question, you know, and so I'm glad to be down here in the middle where it's not as easy to be a target as I am up in the front. I think the WCC has done a better job of this than the National Council, honestly, and I think that the National Council has been so preoccupied with other issues and with its own survival, candidly, and has been behind. If the U.S. government was behind the ball. And you know, kind of not always struggling to catch up about religion and international affairs, the National Council was way behind in understanding the remaking of religious life in this country by not engaging Roman Catholics, by not engaging Pentecostals for a long time, by not engaging the growing evangelical presence, by not engaging people of all the world's religious traditions who lived in their own communities, you know, by somehow digging in to try to protect mainline Protestantism, the National Council really got involved in self-protection. And I'm afraid that it's a heroic and fabulous example up to the civil rights era has really failed us recently in the economy and questions of sexual justice and reflection of the rights of individual people. Dreadful, dreadful work, I think, sadly. And it's sad because there are a lot of good folks. Again, I don't need to be condescending. These are good people who've given their lives, but you get caught up in protecting your turf, just in the same way that our government's gotten caught up protecting turf. The World Council, I think, has done much better, and that's partly because it's made up so vibrantly of folks from the developing world for whom the chance to go to these meetings is so fabulous. And so if you participate in one of these World Council events where folks are coming from the South Pacific, and they've never traveled off of their island, and they're invited to come and where there's been so much attention to lifting up voices, particularly women's voices, that have been so embraced by the World Council of Churches that I think we've seen a better model. It's not a very, it's stronger in some places than in others, obviously. And, you know, one of the problems of that as a kind of a transnational organization is that so much of what they do is so expensive and the kind of calling together of people around the world, that the funds tend to go for the wrong things. You know, and so I think that, candidly, I have not been open to supporting projects of the NCCC or the WCC because I thought that there were more efficient, closer to the ground ways to get at the problems. And I feel bad about it. I was a trustee of the Ecumenical Institute at Bosse, of the World Council of Churches, and I still wouldn't approve grants there because I thought even if you have a lot of resources, as the Luce Foundation is privileged to have, they're still limited, and you've got to figure out what can make the most difference. That's the reason we thought the PIAP project was so promising, was it looked to me like the denominational partnership with the seminary and then with an established partnership in Thailand with a very, very interesting place there on the Thai-Burmese border, where there was really the chance for transformation, and that a small number of dollars could change the lives of some individual folks here, and that you would then go on and change the lives of people all around the world.
Yeah. Oh. I was encouraged to hear you articulate lots of the potential of seminaries to address religion, and I wonder, though, whether in your view seminaries... In my opinion, I'm looking for you to correct me, we're very good at theology, but I'm not so sure we're so good at religion. All the potential is there, and I wonder what's going on to, or might go on to help seminaries engage the question of preparing religious leaders in a world that's religious, not just theological.
That's another gazillion-dollar question that I'm not very well prepared to answer, I think it's real. I said that the Luce Foundation's work has been primarily in the preparation of religious leadership. You know, that's been our focus. And after decades, really, of preparing mainline Protestants, we've decided that our key issue should be preparing people to serve and interact in a religiously plural society, whether they're coming at it as MCC pastors or as UCC pastors or Presbyterian pastors or Lutherans, to think that they have an opportunity but also responsibility to engage this religiously plural society. The people often describe faculty meetings that the politics in faculty meetings are so fierce because the stakes are so little and they are so small. And that often tends to be the way that theology is understood in a wider world, that people don't even know what these theological questions are all about. You know, isn't it, you know, and what is it that you do? What is it you study in seminary? What is it, you know, what are these historic issues that you're still battling over? Don't you just love Jesus and want to change the world? You know, I mean, that set of things makes the work of theological education enormously difficult to be understood in the world and appreciated. Because, honestly, and people can understand why cancer research matters and why it's important to dig in deeper and deeper and keep challenging certain kinds of findings, but they can't understand it about theology. And they particularly don't understand why we keep beating one another up. You know, aren't we all in this together? People find religious division scandalous, you know, and they find it demeaning. And it means that our work is so difficult if we want to be involved in peacemaking, if we can't reconcile one another. And so, I have spent most of my life, I'm an Episcopalian, I spent most of my life as a Roman Catholic. I love the Roman Catholic Church's teaching kind of about sort of a seamless understanding of life. At the same time, I really do believe in the Supreme Court's position in terms of women's right to terminate pregnancies. It's something that has put me in enormous personal conflict over the years. And I thought, in my sphere of influence, I really have a responsibility to encourage people to cherish life in all of its forms. But in my responsibility as a citizen, knowing what the history of this movement has been, I really have a responsibility to support the government's position. I also have a responsibility always to challenge the government's position. And so in terms of our work about religion and international affairs, I've got a responsibility to support, and I have a responsibility to engage. A few years ago, and this, I think it's time for lunch and I should quit, but let me close with this anecdote. I told you how stupid I felt about U.S. Protestants when I went to work at the ATS. After the World Trade Center attack, my mother, living in a small town in Ohio, called me and said, "Aren't you afraid to live in New York?" And my office was in the 46th story of this fancy building, Rockefeller Center. And I said, "Do you mean am I afraid that an airplane is going to hit my building and I'm going to be turned to toast in my building?" And she said, "Well, yes, actually that's what I was asking you." And I said, "You know, that doesn't frighten me. What frightens me is that I wear trifocals and then I go up and down the subway stairs at crowded times of the day and I'm afraid I'm going to slip and be trampled, and or that I'm going to break my leg and I don't know how I'll get to work on crutches." I said, "That really does worry me. This is a real concern for me." She said, "That's stupid." But then I started like exploring how stupid I am, and I realized that in my office on the 46th floor, I did not know where the emergency staircases were. And I was the president, you know, and I had a responsibility to my team of folks to get us out, you know, because this is a real pater familias kind of structure. And I thought, I need to know where the staircases are. And I think that maybe that metaphor could sum up what it is we need to do. We need to know where the staircases are. We need to get better at risk assessment, to know where the real dangers are, and to know who we are in the midst of them, and then to put on our pants one leg at a time and do the best we can, and to encourage other folks to do the best they can, and really to pull together toward that good end. It really is lunchtime. Thank you so much for coming. It's a pleasure.
Thank you once again for coming this morning for this annual Gregory Lecture. There is a brochure that you may want to pick up on the way out that describes the list of lectures for the rest of the year. We encourage you to pick one up and take a look and to come and participate in the many events here at Lancaster Theological Seminary. Have a great day. God bless.